know, to look at this thing in its full complexity, that's one of the most important things to bring up. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salieri Report. We are back with Carl von Wolfram. We had a wonderful conversation, but I have to tell you, the feedback was marvelous. Everybody wants to hear from you.
It's great to hear that. Yeah.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think between our audience and you, there's a real, you know, a real resonation. They want to look at the world in a more complex way. Mm-hmm. So they're looking for people who really understand the world in a much more complex way. Mm-hmm. And they were very, they took to you instantly. So I have huge demand to get you back on the Salieri Report.
Well, I'm grateful, of course, to you that you've made that happen.
Well, we've been sitting here in the pre-interview, and it's hard because you and I think could talk forever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so
and argue forever.
Yeah, but I think that's part of discovering how.
Of course.
Yeah. So I don't mean to be combative.
No. I realize that. No. I admire you greatly, as you know. And we've had this in our first session, too. Yeah. We are a mutual admiration. Having done with the mutual admiration segment of this session,
well, it's
let's see because, what you want to talk about.
Because you come at things politically and I come at them financially. You know, so I'm looking at the money.
Right.
And you're looking at the political mechanisms. And what we're trying to do is look at them together.
Right.
So we want to talk about, there's sort of four areas I want to talk about today. And the first is, I see the push for control as accelerating.
Yes.
And there are a couple of critical issues that are very important to understand that you understand. And I want to talk about them because, you know, we've watched a period when many of the restrictions that people are dealing with in their day-to-day life are ramping down. So mm-hmm. they think, oh, you know, it's getting better. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what's going on behind the scenes, no, it's getting worse. Mm-hmm. So I want to talk about two, and that is the WHO Treaty, which mm-hmm. I see as being unbelievably important. Mm-hmm. And then the other is the effort to expand NATO. We just saw the Chinese screaming about the conspiracy to expand NATO all the way, you know, literally around the world.
Yeah.
So, and I've never seen a Chinese foreign minister be as blunt and rude, and which is extraordinary.
Right,
anyway, we'll get to that. But let's dive in first. The WHO Treaty. What's happening with the WHO Treaty and why is it so important?
Well, the WHO Treaty is at this moment, as it were, the spare point of the next phase in the attempt to take over the world by what you may call Davos, what is often abbreviated as Davos. We have decided earlier we are dealing with a crime syndicate, separate entities, each attempting to accomplish something that they've wanted to accomplish for quite a while, and using the crises that have sort of gripped many countries all over the world with this manufactured COVID-19 pathogen that was not a real threat, except for the early versions that came out of the laboratories and that were genetically, that were with a gain of function, that were. And then what has happened is that the idea was that by 2030, in 8 years' time, it would have had to accomplish its main purpose, the so-called Great Reset, the Agenda 2030. And the Great Reset is about the great final victory of the top of the private sector interests, the very large corporations, the investment firms like BlackRock, and of course the central banks, and a select group of multi-billionaires, hyper-billionaires. They're richer than multi-millionaires. We can't hardly imagine extent of their riches. And this will be then start a new world in which we are underlings, we are going to be enslaved, essentially. That's what the idea is. And yes, I think also there is an accelerated tempo. Now, the WHO is a crucial element in this. As you know, the WHO is today owned, controlled by Bill Gates. He is crucial. He has been crucial all along.
He's one of the largest funders.
Yeah, and he is. But that's not only that. He's through Gavi, it's one of his institutes and one of his foundations or whatever. And many countries are involved in this. He has a kind of diplomatic immunity because at the WHO they consider him a member country as a person. But he has, aside from that, he's just essentially the boss. You get this from people who work in the WHO and who have long, you know, seen.
He's the syndicate representative at the WHO.
He is a member of the syndicate, a very important member.
Right.
And so the next move is something that will enlarge on the treaty that already existed in 2005 that was signed. Countries had no idea what the result would be, but they signed a treaty that said, in case there is a pandemic, we will have the WHO advising and it was unclear whether it was just advising or dictating to the health officials of every country to follow their instructions.
Right.
So nobody could be against that. We were, you know, the WHO is a reliable UN outfit, and who would think what happened eventually, of course, was that we had 2 years of an attempt to establish a totalitarian system because of these totally insane and completely unnecessary instructions originally from the WHO, but then later gained their own momentum through instructions through, say, the American health system, Fauci and a lot. And of course, the same in Europe. At this moment, they are conferring for a new treaty, and that treaty will give the WHO the authority to dictate to all countries policies related to the next pandemic.
Right.
And the next pandemic could be a health pandemic, but also a pandemic following from natural events like this other crazy thing, the climate hysteria about the human emission of CO2. And
they get to define and declare the pandemic.
They can, and in actual fact,
right,
you can put anything under these headings. So this is, you will then establish the WHO as the master above the constitutions of all countries that sign.
It's the end of all national sovereignty.
Exactly.
Right.
The only country so far that has publicly said, very openly stated, we are not going to sign anything, is the Russian Federation. And I think other countries are leaning that way.
You have four countries that are not members of WHO. There are four.
Well, there's, of course, there's North Korea, is not, and there are some countries, but they're not considered part of an important part
right.
of the... So this is the next step, and if they sign... I'm not sure. I think it's I think that two-thirds have to sign.
So let me ask you, the first press release that the WHO put out this year said that they were pushing for signatures and a treaty to go into effect in May 2024.
That's right.
But there's been an indication now, particularly from the Americans, that they think they can jumpstart the process and get it done in 2022, is that correct?
Well, you see, we have another thing happening, and that is the new pandemic coming. Yeah, and that is avian flu.
Right.
And already they are killing very large numbers, millions of feathery creatures in the U.S. And
right.
I think it's coming in Europe too. There is already science here and there. Right. It's the new misinformation about the threat of another virus.
I'll put the link up with this. There's a very good documentary by the UK Column on one of the last times they played this game and slaughtered millions of livestock in Britain using the Imperial College models. Yeah. We know how well they work.
Right.
So they've engineered these kinds of wars on the food supply and the livestock and the farmers before. So this is...
It helps. I mean, the food supply is under threat anyway, for many reasons, and also as a result of the sanctions on Russia, and there's so many things that work together to create a food crisis.
So, just background on this, not to talk about now, but for many years, you know, well more than a decade, I've argued that the Anglo-American Alliance wants control of the food supply to replace petro. So they've wanted to go from an oil standard to a food standard. And if you look at how they engineered both the Uruguay round of GATT and then Doha, and their big push was going to be through Doha, and it failed because India stopped it.
Yeah.
And so they keep looking for ways of controlling the food supply, and I think it's very caught up with controlling the currency. So
they all connected. You are better on the financial end of it. Of course, I have also tried to give myself an education on it. But now it all works together.
Right.
The question always is, how much weight do you give every element, every factor in this?
Right.
And it's easy to go wrong on that.
Yes.
And there should be far more serious discussion and serious publications on it. But we have our biggest problem, maybe, if I have to say, the single biggest problem is that we do not have the means to talk with each other anymore through published media. I mean, we can't. The media in Europe are airtight on this propaganda bomb that exploded over the Atlantic basin, spreading fallout and radiation and making everybody crazy. And the media, with few exceptions, they're
so one of airtight. One of our sections, we're going to talk about the disinformation, which is you're right. This bomb, it is a bomb. WHO treaty, so many, I think it's not commonly understood what's in the works to pop out on people through the WHO. And so the question is, if you're the average person, how do you stop this?
The same answer that you would give to people who've asked, how do you stop the COVID-19 restrictions? Don't participate.
Right.
Never wear a mask. Throw out your QR code from your phone.
Yeah.
Don't participate.
I'm trying to figure out how to throw out my smartphone.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what...
Well, I mean, there are some people who, like me, use the phone only for phoning.
Right.
But there are also people who are addicted to their phones. And you see this because they're forever...
Right.
It's a scene out of 1984 of George Orwell.
Right.
So that is the answer. Don't participate.
So while the WHO, it's almost as though they went 10 different ways, tracks to control the world. But while the WHO treaty is being worked on, we also see a move to extend NATO, literally, globally.
Yeah. Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about what...
Well, okay, NATO is very a very different organization from what it was when it was set up. When it was set up as only a defensive organization. It would never...
Operation Gladio started
away. Hold on. No, wait a moment. Yeah, no, it's very important to see this.
Uh-huh.
Operation Gladio came out of something else. And this is another area, but NATO was set up as a defensive organization and would never, ever attack anybody. It started attacking Kosovo,
The covert operations were offensive from the beginning.
No. This is where people do not understand the history of NATO.
Okay.
NATO became a completely different organization the moment the reasons for its existence disappeared, right, which was with the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right.
I mean, NATO had...
But they were engineering election rigging and other things from the beginning.
No, NATO didn't do that. This was... I think that NATO was kept to its originally... There may have been operations that people didn't know about and that perhaps some people in NATO participated in. That, I think, is quite possible. But it started... It started operations that were offensive the moment the reasons for its existence had disappeared.
Right.
There was a time when the reasons for its existence disappeared, when there were genuine discussion in Europe, also in the Netherlands, about should we abolish it right away? Or should we enlarge it and turn it into an association for collective security? And then we invite... the Russian Federation to participate, and the former countries of the Warsaw Pact. Of course, they were the vassal states of the Soviet Union, the satellite countries. And there was a discussion that was taken seriously for a bit, but Washington wanted a unipolar world with unchallenged hegemony over the entire world. That's after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Right.
And, you know, they were in a position to make that credible, that was possible. And, of course, I think they had most of Europe on their side, the American side for this. But NATO then was used. It was very useful because NATO was, a piggy bank for the military-industrial complex.
Exactly.
It's only Europeans to buy... American stuff that and the military industrial complex that is an engine that runs on it's like a free wheel. It just continues and continues.
Right.
So it could be replaced by another engine that is good for as a Keynesian engine underneath the economy, like looking after infrastructure, etc. But I think we discussed that the last time.
Right.
And but that means making so many changes and killing off so many profitable channels to too many people that it hasn't happened.
So NATO has steadily gained membership across Eastern Europe. Is that?
It was Clinton. It was Baker, James Baker had promised to Gorbachev. This was when the issue of German reunification was being discussed. And Gorbachev was obviously worried about a united Germany, because after all, the Germans had been a problem, to put it mildly, for Russia for a very long time. And so James Baker said, that NATO would not extend one inch eastward. And that promise was later confirmed by many European heads of state. So it's not something that you can say, well, it's net news or something, that it's fake news, which of course is what the so-called fact checkers are saying. Is all is not true. It's fake news. No, it's not fake news, and you can trace it. Many heads of state concurred.
Right.
So what happened was that Clinton, also people were not sure why. Maybe because of the Polish vote or something like that. It's hard to. There's a number of theories. He just suddenly made several countries a member, and. This is something.
Do you remember the year, the first year he did?
No, I would have to.
Okay, we'd have to go look it up. I'll look it
this
up.
This is well, Clinton. I mean, when was he president? And after that, it became much more, because it became clear you could use those in NATO who were willing, the coalition of the willing that was under George W. Bush. You could use them for operations. You could use them to clear up things. You could use them to do certain tasks that American military didn't want to do in Iraq, in Afghanistan, mm-hmm. and so on. And then, of course, it starts expanding. The North Atlantic Treaty starts expanding to the North Pacific. This is, of course, against China. This goes on. I think that what has recently happened, and this I'm going running ahead of the story, which you may not like, but it's we are also seeing the beginnings of the end of NATO. It can't continue. But that's a story we get to later.
Okay. So Clinton started with the bombing of Kosovo. You know, we started to see the NATO become very, really on the offense. So why did Europe agree to that? Why did Europe go along with NATO turning to literally military offense?
Well, there was some disunity at that time.
Uh-huh.
I think that there was not a... I remember, not very clearly, but I remember... also in the media in the Netherlands, there was considerable disagreement.
Right.
I discussed this at the time with my former editor, foreign editor, who was also a deputy chief editor. And we were, it was clear that there was not great unity. It okay. had to be, it, I mean, of course, it was in the end... there was not an effective opposition to it, but well, there wasn't. I mean, Europe has functioned more so after the collapse of the Soviet Union than after World War II. Europe was a bunch of vassals of the U.S., but right. originally
except
idea.
Except for the U.K.
Also, you know, I remember moments, times where the Brits were told, no, you're going, you have to go to another window for this. You know, it's that began during. I mean, the post-war, the Cold War, Europe was more of a ally, a genuine ally. Of course, a subordinate ally. There was never any doubt who was the primus inter pares, of course. There was never any doubt about that. But it became a vassal. The alliance changed, and it became a system of vassalage after the collapse of the Soviet Union.
So NATO has moved steadily, has added members steadily, and is encircling Russia.
Yeah.
But they're also making moves into Asia. So we get to the Ukraine, and one of the big issues, of course, in the Ukraine was Russia was clear they did not want Ukraine going into the EU or NATO. Now, let me just stop there and tell you a story. In 2019, I went to Copenhagen with a friend who was giving a speech. And believe it or not, the reason I went to Copenhagen is I've always wanted to see Little Mermaid. So it was kind of a break for me. And I accompanied him to his speech.
Mm-hmm.
And he was speaking about anthroposophy. He was not there to talk politics. No. But in the middle of the speech, he just happened to make a reference to NATO. He wasn't talking about NATO. He wasn't there to discuss NATO. He wasn't interested in NATO. It just came up. And a man in the audience, and it was a very respectable, well-educated, well-heeled audience, small, broke in, interrupted him in the middle of the speech, which is extraordinary in a conversation like that, and said with absolute fear in his voice, "Do not mention NATO. We could go to prison, you know, you can be prosecuted and go to jail if you criticize NATO." And the whole audience, the whole place just froze. And I tried to confirm this later, and my understanding is legislation had been proposed, but I'm not clear that it had passed. I could never get final confirmation on that. But you were not allowed to discuss NATO. And the fear in the room was extraordinary. And I thought, what happened in Denmark?
Well, you know, but that might have been in connection with some particular Danish political moment.
Right.
Because that kind of situation, I don't recall existing here or in Germany or
so
in
this
Belgium,
was Danish legislation. I will tell you, I just got back from Sweden.
Mm-hmm.
And the tension over the last decade in Sweden of the pressure from the Americans to join NATO. I mean, it sounds like a political war that is just extraordinary. And of course, we've seen the articles about the politics in Finland. So
this is, again, it's an impulsive move, an impulsive statement by the Prime Minister of Finland, who is a very young lady, and she is on social media, and she feels the pressure, this pro-Ukraine pressure, etc. And she wants to show, demonstrate virtue. I mean, she is part of a generation that believes in a lot of virtue signaling of many things. I mean, she's that is clear. I also think that she is still wet behind the ears. And she then spontaneously said, we have to apply for membership. I don't think that the Finns, who have the longest history of working with the Russians in some sort of, with an arrangement throughout there was, of course, a war with Finland and Russia. And the Finns were greatly admired the world over, the way in which they stood their ground. And I remember in Moscow I was at a time when there was a commemoration. I think this was around May, the 9th of May, the commemoration of the end of the war, etc. And I went to a war museum, and I saw there some old Soviet military bedecked with medals. So wonderful, wonderful people to see. And I asked them, what was your most memorable? And they said, the war with Finland. And I asked them, what did you think? And they said, they were opponents. It's incredible. It's just a little this. So I don't think that the Finns who are still there in Finland, whereas this young lady who calls herself prime minister because she's happened to win an election, that these people who have the experience of working with Russia are going to say, yes, why don't we become a member of... I don't think so.
So, but when you look at these two efforts, the Hague Treaty and the NATO, I didn't send it to you. I just saw an extraordinary speech in April by the Chinese foreign minister. You know, the Chinese are always so careful, always so, you know, not threatening other people's face. This guy was furious and basically made it sound like NATO was a conspiracy to take over the world. You know, and he referred to it coming to... You could see how frustrated and angry he was.
Yeah.
It was bubbling over with his frustration. And you've seen that from the Indians, too. So, but you see this push by the... you almost have a... I almost have this image of the health guy saying, oh, we can take over the world first. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's like a race by different cartels. The military guys are trying to take it over through NATO. You know, the weapons manufacturers are trying to take over the world through the NATO, and the health guys are trying to take it over through the WHO. And it's a race of these different cartels to assert complete central control. And the frustrating thing about it is, it in one sense, it's so ridiculous.
Of course it is.
It's so ridiculous. Oh. But the harm that it's doing is so devastating.
Well, the reaction also, I think, you have to see the reaction in terms of you are insulting our intelligence, my intelligence. You dare make fun of us. Don't do that.
Right.
I mean, this is, I don't think that they are scared of NATO expanding in the... This NATO is not going to be effective anywhere. I think that NATO exists... They're a bunch of cowards, basically. They're not going to fight China. They're not going to fight over Taiwan or anything like that. They're not going to fight Russia. I mean, this is something so very clear. NATO doesn't want to... That the member states of NATO don't want to fight Russia. I mean, right. Stoltenberg, the Norwegian head, the official head of NATO, says that it is about time that we do, but the member states won't fight Russia in Ukraine. Of course not. They're volunteers. Right. And there are some, there are instructors, NATO instructors that have been, that have infiltrated the military, the Ukrainian military since 2014, since the coup d'etat.
So one of issues that many people listening to this, or some people may not understand, is that there is a provision in the NATO agreements, Article 5,
yeah.
So that if one country is attacked, it's a collective self-defense, all the other countries automatically have to help defend.
That's right.
So if America should have a false flag and then exercise an Article 5, everybody has to join the war on terrorism because America's been
attacked. If they still believe it. Well, there's a lot of disbelief.
Why would that be?
I think this is important to see that the official facade of NATO, I mean, you mentioned Article 5, In its whatever you call it, the charter, it says that a country can only become a member if it's invited to do so. You can't apply for membership, and then it can only be accepted by the rest of NATO if that country is not involved in a war or in a situation where it could easily be drawn in war. I mean, this is part of the charter. Right. So the NATO, by saying, become members, and, Ursula von der Leyen goes to Kiev and gives Zelensky a list of, this is fill in, and, if you fill it in right, this is about the EU, but it is the same, it works the same way with NATO. It's a...
Well, here's the question. Did Zelensky have his shirt on, and was he wearing leather pants?
No, anyway, some of this is too silly to be, to be taken seriously.
Right.
But it is a problem, of course, because NATO is a facade, and you can do a lot of things behind that facade, and you can claim, the Europeans are with us. The Europeans are engaged by NATO. They can't have their own foreign policy because they have NATO. And it is when you have a defense policy that is looked after by the U.S., then you can't have a foreign policy that is independent.
I mentioned to you, I just saw the video of the French reporter reporting on the fact that the Americans were running the Ukrainian military.
Well, they're running. Yeah, this is something. They are running the people that volunteer to fight in Ukraine,
right?
Which means they're certain death if they ever get caught. So these people are sorted out by American officials. So it's the Americans but we know that behind the scenes the Americans are in fact running the military operation.
So it sounded to me as though it was a military veteran, but probably a mercenary or contractor, is what it sounded like to me.
I think that, of course, they're contractors. I think we discussed this the last time.
Yeah.
But we see more and more that Mariupol, the big steelworks in Mariupol, there's a whole network of tunnels underneath, and they're hiding the most steadfast of over 1,000 normal Ukrainian soldiers. So that's the original Ukrainian armed forces have surrendered and have gone home.
Right.
They have gone home. They could go home to their wives, you know, don't come back fighting us, and it's all fine. But there are some very, the diehards are underneath. This is the what has remained of the Azov, so-called Azov battalion.
Right.
And they have foreigners with them in this complex. And it's generally understood that there is a significant detachment of the French Foreign Legion. Of course, they're also, well, you know, they're a specialist in this kind of thing. Well, plus an American general, plus...
one of my concerns is the dramatic increase in corporate mercenary capacity given...
Yeah. As Eric Prince and what is now called Academie.
But it's given the I call it the Anglo-American Alliance, the capacity to cook these things up.
Outsourcing of war.
Yeah.
And we've seen this in...
But
in,
to outsource war so you can cook it up to the point where you can build the coalitions to get...
We've seen it in Iraq. We've seen it in Afghanistan. I think at some point in Iraq, from what I remember, half the fighting people there, or half the military people there, were mercenaries.
So I just met with people who have a lot more experience in European politics than I do, and I said, why would the Germans go along? You know, because the whole idea of the global chessboard is keep the Germans from getting together with the Russians. Why would the Germans go along with this? And he said, the Germans have been promised the Ukraine. The German industrialists, they think they're going to get the Ukraine, and they're kind of, you know, licking their chops, and that's, they think it's going to work.
They would absolutely love it. They would. It's the that Azovstal, that complex that I mentioned just earlier, is the biggest steel. It's I think two.
Yeah, for the
two
Silk
factories.
Road.
It's the biggest in steel works in the world.
Right, and then you have the.
And it could do a lot. I mean, it could be very valuable, of course, to the Russians, and to the Germans, as you say. Now, if the Germans manage to become friends with the Russians, then they have a good chance. And who knows?
But if they can pick the whole thing up cheap through NATO...
They can't. I mean, what
well,
can
they
NATO
think they
do?
Can.
No, I don't think that. I don't think so. No, of course not. How could they?
I think
and NATO would have to. NATO would have to occupy Ukraine.
I think that, no, all they have to do is get the Ukraine in the EU... And then all these assets, because they've been devastated by what's happened, can be picked up for cheap.
No, but the Ukraine is not going to be part of the EU.
These guys think it's
going to
work.
Yeah, they think so, but no, it's not going to happen.
Well, but
if that happens, it's also the end of the EU.
Why do they think so?
we are told to lower our voices. I told the editor could sort of turn up and down.
But these guys think they're going to win.
No, they don't think that.
You think they think they're going to fail?
That's the propaganda. That's the psyop. We're winning.
No, I don't mean they're going to win.
The idea that NATO is winning in Ukraine is part of the psyop.
No, I think they believe over a long period of time, the sanctions are going to work, and the Russians will not be able to assert. The multipolar sovereign, you know, sovereign, national sovereignty in a multipolar world.
Well, I think they're very wrong. The sanctions have backfired.
I know you think they're wrong, but why do they believe they're right?
No, they don't think so. I think that it's part of the psyop. You mislead a lot of people, and those people include some of the people that are pretty high up in governments and in institutions that participate in government. Of course. So these people may believe it, but the people who think, the people who have worked it out, the people who've really thought it out, and they're not being reduced to zero, those people, in the US or in Europe, they don't believe that. They see this as a result of the PSYOP, of the succession of PSYOP.
I think the Brits and the Americans really believe they're going to win. I think they think over a long period of time, the sanctions will so drain Russia, and the demographics in Russia are going against Russia, that they can end up relatively in a more powerful position than if they didn't do this.
The demographics part I have not studied closely, but I have seen what has happened as a result of the sanctions, which has forced Putin to take a number of measures that have really backfired and that have, of course, created a situation in Europe that's almost untenable. And that is going to force the German industrialists to come to some decision at some point pretty soon. You have the CEO of the largest chemical corporation in the world, BASF, saying that if this continues and if we don't change it, the situation, then Germany is going to suffer through the absolute worst conditions comparable to the German conditions at the end of the war. So you have to think of inside Germany at the end of the war. It's unbelievable.
Right.
And he is a very important industrialist.
Right.
And there are many other German industrialists who think like him. And they want Nord Stream 2. They want the gas. They want an unimpeded flow from the other gases. It's 40% to Europe. And it's at the moment they cannot do that, of course. But at the moment, everybody has to demonstrate it's virtue signaling from here to there.
But why?
But at some point, they're going to work on. And then Scholz will have a decision to make. Is he going to step down? Is he going to change his government? Is he going to, or is he going to be replaced?
Right.
Okay. We are living in revolutionary times. I guarantee you that. And that's as a result of what Putin has done in reaction to the sanctions and the freezing of Russian assets in Western banks.
Now, do you believe that part of the goal, and I'll just call it the Anglo-American alliance, do you think one of their goals is regime change and they think they can get it?
Regime change where?
In Russia.
It's always, this is a desire that is very old, that goes back, of course, to the Yeltsin years.
Right.
When it almost happened.
Well, my impression is the Americans made a decision not to bring the government down completely. I mean, they just, they wrecked the place. But they were afraid of, if there was no government, what would happen to the nuclear capacity. It's what they said.
No, I think that Russia was on the point of disintegration.
Right.
When Putin inherited the presidency from Yeltsin, the last day of the 20th century. It was New Year's Eve, 20th century. And he was immediately aware of the great threat to the Russian Federation of disintegrating. It would fall apart in feudal type. And the oligarchs had established themselves as minor princes with their own armies, their own police force and everything. And so what Putin had to do from the outset was an enormous complex balancing act with not one opponent, but with a whole assortment of opponents. And these were the Atlanticists in Moscow and in St. Petersburg, who believed that the future as part of Europe and the whole Western thing was preferable. And of course, maybe they were thinking correctly, but it was the United States didn't want that. Because that would have meant, undermining of the hegemonic ambition. So then gradually Putin managed to organize the oligarchs. It's a long story and very interesting story. Some could remain and others were sort of in exile or self-imposed exile. And he did so very well. It was when I saw that happening, I thought, this is a statesman of a caliber that we haven't seen anywhere. This is so well done. I mean, this is Bismarck. This is then, of course, we always got this opposition. It never disappeared. There was always a fifth column There were always NGOs were allowed to operate in Moscow with the specific purpose of undermining the Russian Federation.
He finally kicked them out.
And he finally got rid of them. As a result of this, of the sanctions were the means, the sanctions placed upon Russia were the means for Putin to respond in a way that the West was not prepared for. And of course, it was a masterstroke. The fact that they had left Russian assets in Western banks was a trap. You hear some critics saying it was Elvira Nevolina, the governor of the Russian Central Bank, who comes out of this nest of neoliberal reformers. But it was a mistake by her. No, this was a trap. And the US jumped right into this trap, making clear to all and sundry that your savings are not safe in Western banks if you do something that the US doesn't like, because it will freeze your assets.
So the US has done this before. Russia's not the first.
No.
Russia's just the first. No.
Venezuela right. got its asset by the Brits. And Venezuela, it's a small place. It was the Brits. This wasn't the same thing.
Right.
And there were maybe other things. But this is so big. I mean, the Russian assets is not nothing. It was so big that this was momentous. And what it has meant is that it's the end of the petrodollar. Finished.
But let me just say, because it's getting more complicated. They froze the Russian assets and the central banking assets.
Yeah.
But what they've also done, the first payment by the Russians, so the United States debt is approximately 140% of their GDP. Russia's debt is approximately 18%.
Yes, practically right. nothing.
So Russia does not, you know, the Anglo-American alliance always put people in a debt trap, and they can't put Russia
right.
in a debt trap.
Right.
That's part of the lesson Russia learned after right. the 90s.
That's right.
So on the first debt payment, the Russians, I think it was Citibank, agreed to process the payment, and the payment got made. Now the Western banks are refusing to process the payment. So even though the Russians can't use their money sitting in the bank accounts in the Western banks refuse to process their payment to pay the debt. And they're trying to take the position that the Russians are defaulting on the
right.
debt. In my world, this is called a contrived default.
Yes.
Because they're not letting you pay the debt no. service, and then they're saying you defaulted.
It doesn't concern Putin. I mean, he's way above it. What he has done has had far greater impact. He's brought gold back. And that means that other countries too are thinking.
I'm going to stop you there because Putin started in 2005 to bring the gold back. So he's been accumulating gold and moving to this. And we've watched the global rebalancing of the gold inventory since then. So this has been going on for a long time.
Yeah, but he's bringing the gold back as support of the ruble.
No. He's brought it back in support of the ruble domestically, not
yes.
internationally. What he also did is he set up an office, the Central Bank of Russia set up an office many years ago in China so they could transact gold. So he's got gold transacting with the Chinese through Beijing, through Moscow, Beijing, direct linkage, and he's got it as a set domestically, but it's not a gold standard globally.
Okay, a very important a bit of news that you must have seen, I think, is that when this was developing, in the early stages of its development, since Putin's measures, it was Biden, or at least somebody on behalf of Biden, who called the Saudis. The Saudis were the origin
right.
of the petrodollar.
Right, right.
No answer.
Mm-hmm.
It's the first time
right.
that the Saudis haven't responded. We haven't answered a call from the American president.
So
what does it mean? The Saudis and China have made a deal.
Mm-hmm.
India and China have made a deal. The Saudis and they're all making deals.
Right.
And it's not with petrodollars.
Right.
It's with gold and their own currency.
Right.
And they are developing, or they're trying to develop, they have to still, from what I understand, they still have to find a real formula for a substitute of a reserve currency. And the Chinese and the Russians are working on that together.
So if you, I think I sent you our wrap-up state of our currency, but if you look at the work they've been doing through the BRICS for 15 years to build all these things, they've been working on this steadily for 15 years.
That's right.
And now what they're trying to do. So in 2019, the BRICS agreed to China, India, yeah. Russia yeah. to come up with a cold-backed BRICS currency. That's when the Americans moved with the going direct and the G7 bankers moved with going direct. And,
right.
and to a certain extent, going direct was meant to sort of jump the curve on the BRICS plan.
Yeah.
And so the BRICS thing kind of seemed to fall apart. And now they're trying to negotiate a commodity-based basket.
Yeah, that's instead another of just, one of the things.
Instead of
and
just
it's
gold.
Out of it is this is a, we are living in revolutionary times. The
yep.
situation has dramatically changed. The world has changed. It's a very good Dutch expression. It's on loose screws. It can, you know, it goes it can go anywhere. And in fact, it is on such loose screws that you wonder whether there are still screws left.
Right.
So this is our situation. And a lot of what we are saying is speculation based on insufficient information, but especially insufficient understanding of the complexity of the results that can happen.
So,
but this is what I want to talk about a little bit more in detail because
yes.
it's vitally important. Several other things have happened that I think are crucially important for much of Asia, even for Japan, and for the South, for South Asia, for Africa and Latin America.
So there are two things I wanted to point out to you. One is, you know, the last time we talked about this, I said one of the questions was, who would the South support? Because when you come to these moments when the BRICS start to organize, the U.S. is always, or the Anglo-American Alliance is always able to sort of divide and conquer the South and keep the South from supporting, in this case, the Russians and China. And if you look at the map...
they're intimidated all the time.
Well, but here's the thing. If you look at the map, nobody's come swarming in support of the Anglo-American Alliance. The South has not gone along.
I mean, exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Well, that's big.
Yeah.
That's huge.
It's huge.
It's huge.
It's huge.
Okay, so I want to mention something else. I saw the Indian foreign minister was in the U.S. for a summit on the including on the sanction issues. And here's a guy who's as schooled in diplomacy. You know, he's not quite a Lavrov, but he's good. And he's shaking with frustration because they're trying to get him to say that the Indians will go along with the sanctions on buying Russian gas.
Let me
finish.
I have a prediction. Okay.
And he's literally shaking. He's saying, he said, the U.S. and Europe is currently importing in an afternoon more Russian oil and gas than we buy in a month.
Right.
And what he's saying, it's the same thing as the foreign minister from China. The divide is, to these people, words have no meaning. And they feel free to say up is down and down is up. And he's trying to negotiate as if words have meaning.
Yeah.
And these two worlds are clashing because one is got no screws left.
Right.
And the other is trying to buckle down.
Exactly.
Is trying to get the screws in
place.
That's
very well, extremely well said. I wish I'd thought of that.
Well, he's trying to get the screws back in place.
Back in, yeah.
And these
it
guys,
won't work. Yeah.
Right.
Wonderful.
Right.
Maybe this is the title of your... Anyway, my predictions, small predictions.
Uh-huh.
With India, we are going to see an American media, that's going to get itself worked up about human rights violations in India. Prediction. For Pakistan, it was too late. It happened before anything could be predicted.
I was stunned that they were able to take Khan out. I couldn't.
A regime change in Pakistan.
Right.
There are millions on the streets in Lahore and Rawalpindi, everywhere.
Really?
They are not accepting it.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, it's absolutely, it's unbelievable. And then you think, okay, the Pakistan military are in a powerful position.
Right.
Evil tongues say they run the show. But they are not going to settle for this. And also,
really?
already, wow. Now okay. We don't know for sure, right. Already the Pakistanis have so much benefit of Chinese One Belt, One Road infrastructural investing. They're not going to sit idly by and allow this color revolution regime change to continue. So unless Washington pulls something out of its head that is at this moment impossible to predict, and that is a possibility, this is not going to go through. But who knows? It's an one little thing that is happening and that has repercussions throughout the whole Eurasian region, because we had a Eurasian bloc that was taking shape and was consolidating. And Pakistan was part of it. And India was part of it. Imagine, India and Pakistan together. Unbelievable.
Right.
So all these things hang together. And all these things, it means eliminating that very essential American influence that was throughout everything, through the hairlines of everything.
So I see a couple things operating here, and I just want to flush them out. One is this desire. Many people who have gone along in the past are not going along because they need a world in which words are real and contracts matter.
Yeah.
So this problem of the neocons and their culture not being agreement capable is big.
Yes.
The second thing that's going on is what, you know, and we don't need to get into it, but I believe that the Anglo-American Alliance and the G7 have very powerful military capacity that is invisible to the common man. And that is what has pulled the rabbit out of the hat in times past. The question is, can it pull it out of the hat now? I don't know. So that's a question mark. But there's something else, and it to a certain extent, it relates to the agreement capable. I think that what is coming through the leadership on the American side is a culture which is so offensive to so many people that they would rather die fighting than live with it.
Well,
and Putin has given that voice more than anyone else.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that we can come back to this when I want to go into this a little bit more fully. But on the U.S., we all know we'll have midterm elections in November.
Very important.
We all know that the laptop Biden, Hunter Biden's laptop, is being revealed. What is on there? We all know that the Democrats must be extraordinarily embarrassed with Biden and maybe telling him, "Why don't you resign in peace and give us a chance to not come out completely down in November." We know that many things are happening, and we know that there is no unity between the federal government and many of the states. We have DeSantis in Florida, we have Mexico, we have Texas, and they are not online. What is forbidden in one state is obligatory in the next with masks, and you can go on a long time. So the U.S., I saw that as a possible point of light in our future, because Europe is totally hopeless at the moment, has been now. The whole 2 years of COVID-19 has been hopeless. But in the U.S., you saw a little spark of hope. And I am very pro-American. Many people think the opposite. Because I also in Japan, I kept saying, watch out with your relationship with the U.S. and you are not, you should not behave as slaves. But I'm not anti-American. I think that the American ruling segment was hijacked by the wrong people, and it started with what we discussed earlier, this whole notion of unipolar rule. And then whatever happens after, you can go into details, etc. But this is a very important element in all this.
Absolutely.
Because the Great Reset, you know, the Great Reset, Davos, or whatever you want to call it, the question is whether the U.S. is still going to go along with that. Many parts of the U.S. are not, I think. But then we come back, then we are talking about the financial bunch that is in the Great Reset, the criminals in the financial world, both the central banks and the Fed, of course, and the investment managers like BlackRock, Larry Fink, and the like, right. etc. There's an area where many things could still happen, also as a response to what Putin is trying to do. But I think at some point, I don't know whether you want to do this now or whether you followed your train of thought, because I am respectful of what you right. how you wanted this to go. But
So there's been this controversy about, on one hand, you have the control grid, which new technology makes it possible for extraordinary central control using digital means. So the passports, the CBDCs, and we've written a lot about that. So you have technology building a control grid. At the same time, which compromises individual sovereignty. At the same time, it's not just individual sovereignty, it's national sovereignty. So you have the Russians and the Chinese pushing hard to protect their national sovereignty, India too. At the same time, if you look internally, they are each in different ways implementing this control grid internally. So, and I believe that control grid very much compromises individual sovereignty, which raises the question, you know, and which creates a lot of confusion. Are they fighting for national sovereignty, but looking internally to control individual sovereignty? So this control impulse is very... Yeah.
I can imagine an answer to the question whether, because these are opinions that do the rounds, that the Chinese and the Russians are in some three-dimensional chess kind of way, secretly and blah, blah, part of the Great Reset.
So that's the question. Are the Russians and the Chinese part of the I call it the going direct reset.
Yeah, okay.
So you're adamant that they are not a separate faction. They're really separate. Even though if you look at, you know, they're loyal, you know, they've pledged allegiance to the Sustainable Development Goals, and they show up at the World Economic Forum.
If you read the Sustainable Development Goals, I don't think anybody disagrees. It's poverty should be wiped out, insecurity should go, we should have an environment that's safe, we should, I mean, but we know, we can read into this what it actually meant, what is actually happening. But on the surface, on the face of it, nobody disagrees with
it. Right. It all sounds perfectly reasonable.
So, I mean, if when Putin meets Xi Jinping at the opening of the Olympic Games, the Winter Games, and they come out with a manifest, the bureaucrats have put that in, because everybody, you know, it's cut and paste. Okay, it means nothing. It's not that Putin and Xi Jinping have been discussing the World Economic Forum in those terms. No, they've been discussing the world in very different terms. And you have to read, you have to really read and listen to what they're saying. And that means no unipolar world. We want a multipolar world, right. And we want respect all around and cooperation all around, and respect and a more than a respect, an understanding that mankind cannot survive unless it realizes the best means of living together.
Right, but if you look at the control grid they're putting into place domestically, the question is, you know, do they want national sovereignty, but do they want to end individual sovereignty?
Oh.
within the country.
I think that the control grid, the digital face recognition, whatever they do, it's a technology that gives a government, any government, the kind of means to keep a check on the population.
But how do
that's,
we know?
That is too. You are not going to do away with it unless there is a very strong public outcry against it. It forces you to come up with a different domestic policy. And the Chinese, this would take us a too long time, because the Chinese control system, the social credit system, is not what many people believe it is. It has a different ultimate purpose. The ultimate purpose is harmony, the absence of conflict that could lead to a disintegration of a community and ultimately the disintegration of China. This is the great fear throughout Chinese history, is disintegration.
Right.
And I know of, because of the history of these control systems that existed before we had the technology, the Japanese imported it. I know how it works it worked in different parts in Japanese history. And I think that I understand, not fully, I don't know 100%, but I think that ultimately you look at this more from a point of view of Confucian understandings, Confucian things that are taken for granted, Confucian beliefs and ideas, than what we think in the way of superimposing total control over an entire population. Well, that is how it is seen in Washington.
So there are two questions. One is, many people in the West who are fighting for individual sovereignty look at Russia and China and say, these are totalitarian societies.
Yeah, they're not.
So that's number one.
Yeah, they're not.
Or they say they're more compromising of individual sovereignty than we want to live.
The idea, the notion that in some secret way, in some three-dimensional chess kind of complicated way, Putin and Xi Jinping are part of the Great Reset. It's something that is doing the rounds now, and it's, I think, a great detraction. And I think also it's being encouraged by the people who want to have the critical media, the alternative media, being distracted.
So
but okay, let me try to, because
okay,
many
you
of these
let
people,
me jump in here.
Many people who say this are, I think, honest people.
Right.
And I think there is a way. I've written about
Can
this only recently.
In?
Yeah.
So, you know, and this is a guess, this is conjecture. I believe the Anglo-American Alliance has done everything they can to get the Russians to invade the Ukraine or to make this move into the Ukraine. I think they engineered it. They put, as John Sawyer said.
We're changing the subject. I'm fully.
No, I'm coming back to it.
Yeah, what you say.
I think they think if they can get the Russians to do this, it will help them.
And they didn't. The Russians didn't do what they wanted them to do.
I disagree.
It's something very different happened.
Well, but I think the Russians, I think they wanted the Russians to take this step.
Not like this. The Russians responded, no, I tell you.
This is helping their reset. In other words.
Yes and no.
Yes.
Yes and no. But not in the way they wanted.
The West is using Russia.
You are completely.
To facilitate their reset.
No, you don't know that part of history.
I believe that the Anglo-American Alliance is using Russia to help them get their reset.
They wanted to, and they didn't succeed, because Russia didn't.
That's not clear to me.
No, they wanted to get Russia to invade Ukraine, but not in the way
that
it happened.
That may be.
That's very important.
That may be.
It's very important.
That may be, but.
It's very important.
You're confident.
They were misreading Putin. They were misreading. You know, I mean, it would take an hour to go into this.
Right.
But it's if you want to do it, I don't think we should. I think we should go on with the private public. Because the people who are saying this, there's a secret, in a secret way, they are supporting the Great Restart. And they have a number of reasons they give for this. They're very slim reasons, flimsy arguments. But they're honest people. And I think that at a time when you have honest people disagreeing on something so important, so fundamental, it sometimes helps to come up with a perspective that is completely different from the commonly expected, the common accepted perspective in which these things are viewed. And I propose to do this with something that is a perspective that's almost forgotten. And that is the perspective of the phenomenon of sovereignty and the phenomenon of a sovereign state having public and private sectors.
Mm-hmm.
Few people have concerned themselves with this, but we can make an immediate pronouncement about the aims of the Great Reset, the aims of Davos. That is the ultimate victory of the private sector, part of the private sector, the elect, the top, not the medium and small businesses, that the ultimate success over all the public sectors of all the countries in the world. That is the success, that's how the success of the Great Restart. So let's talk about private and public. In the private sector, you have entrepreneurs. You have people who try to make money and build capital and whatnot, riches. In the public sector, if it functions the way it's supposed to, you have officials who make sure that the interests of the public, all of us, are looked after. And at the same time, of course, that includes also those things that are necessary for the continuation of the state. Without the state, you don't have sovereignty of anything.
Right.
The state can be sovereign. And if you take away the sovereignty of the state, it means a very important thing. It means that citizenship is no longer possible, because you can only be a citizen of a sovereign state. And it is the public sector that makes sure that your interests as a citizen are looked after in one way or another.
Uh-huh.
So keep this division in mind, public and private. What we see in Russia is the reassertion by Putin of the sovereignty of the Russian Federation, of the state. He has been trying to achieve this by what we mentioned earlier, by gradually getting rid of the opponents that belong to the neoliberal cliques in the cities, the fifth column, people who wanted to undermine Russia, and so on. And he is now more successful than he has been before. The firing of Chubais was for me the ultimate example of this. Here you have a functionary who was, together with Gaidar, at the time of Yeltsin's privatization campaign, he was the architect of privatization.
Right.
And he was kept on by Putin, and he had different positions in this thing. Of course, Putin had to work with the people that were there when he got in. He needed them to rule, to know anything what was happening. He needed the connections, he needed his assistance, etc. And he kept, and the last function that Chubais had was as a kind of emissary to the World Economic Forum, to the sustainable things, etc. That was his official function. He's out. Very, very dramatic, because he was a very well-known and a hugely important figure. Very dramatic move. As just an example, Putin is engaged in resurrecting things that actually never existed to the full in Russia, because Tsarist Russia was partly a relic of feudal times. Now, of course, Tsarist Russia had developed beyond feudalism, but it hadn't had the history that the Europeans post-feudal countries, I mean, feudalism has no distinction between public and private interests, public and private sectors. They emerge gradually over the course of some 200 years with the bourgeoisie, with the importance of cities, with the guilds, with lots of things. Very interesting history. And then you get a fully established state with sovereignty that has two, the public and private sectors that keep order in the society and work very well and that make citizenship possible. So Tsarist Russia didn't have that developed. And when communism took over, command economies in communism do not recognize, by definition, private and public sectors. Right. Everything is public,
right?
Officially. And so when Chubais and Gaidar set out under the guidance of the Harvard economists that were, you know, they were like missionaries there, teaching people how to do things properly in the economy. When they set out to privatize Russian state assets, there was no private sector to put these assets in. So what do? You can't just conjure up out of nothing a private sector. And a great catastrophe, as you know, a great catastrophe ensued that created the oligarchs, the greatest robbery of state assets in the history of mankind. We have never seen anything like that in history, right, in that volume. So then, of course, when Putin then looked at the situation now, he has to make sure that there is a fully equipped and fully equipped private and public sectors that function like private and public sectors. He is actually doing this for the first time. And it is interesting to see then the commentary. You have this well-known Russian geo-economic genius, Glavlev. You've certainly heard about him.
Very capable.
He's very interesting. He's very interesting to read.
Yeah.
And I think that he is on the ball. He is very good on many things he says, except when he goes into historical periods, etc. Then he shouldn't do that, because that's not interesting to begin with. And you can't know these things that you... But he has been critical, very critical, of the central bank. And Elvira Nabulimia. Oh, geez, I keep getting this name. because she has raised the prime rate to 20%. That's when he began critical. Of course, he's lowered it since to 17 because there was a threat of inflation, and she wanted to. And she followed the.
As she was defending the ruble.
Of course, so. And we talked earlier about the assets that were a trap for. I mentioned that earlier, but that is not the important thing, because as the prime minister of Russia, who's also given a speech recently, has said, we don't think of the central bank as the engine behind industrial development. There are other ways. We think of the legal measures we take, we think of all manner of informal ways, etc. We have other parts of the state. We have a legislature, we have an administrative entities. And suddenly, when I heard this, I thought, my God, he says something that I have seen operate successfully when I first came to Japan and I first studied South Korea. Because what they do now, they give preferential treatment to biggies, to the big ones that are considered strategic industries, like shipbuilding, like civil aviation, and aircraft, and so on. So you choose, you select winners. This is anathema in Washington. This is against
Washington.
Of course they do, but in a very hidden way. But here, and the smaller ones, the small entrepreneurs, they are the small and medium-sized ones. They have access to fantastic loans against very favorable rates. And right. we help them in other ways. And I thought, my God, I see Japan in this period of, and in Korea, what this means is import substitution industrialization. It's a mouthful, but it was a very important formula that was used at one time in the time when people were very concerned about the underdeveloped world,
right.
that was then called the developing world, the third world, whatever you wanted to call it. They used that recipe, import substitution industrialization. This is the formula. What you import, you should make yourself. Not everything, of course, that's right. not possible. The Japanese never decided to go into the oil business. They knew they could never, the foreign oil firms had always a preferential treatment among the foreigners. But most of what you imported, you started making yourself. That right. is the industrialization recipe.
Right.
It was followed in Japan, it was followed in South Korea, and in the Philippines. And in the Philippines, I saw what happened to it
right.
when the neoliberals took over. This is the IMF and the World Bank.
The neoliberals and they
stopped it in its tracks. And I saw it in the 60s when I first lived in the Philippines. It was the most prosperous country in Asia after Japan. And then I saw it. I visited it regularly after that. And by the 70s, going into the 80s, all that was gone. And it became subtractor to the rest of the world. And that also meant that those national interests that were part of this whole subcontracting thing, they were the old rich people, of course, and they supplanted the original colonists. This is neocolonialism.
Right.
And it was preached by the IMF and the World Bank and so on. And it became the Washington Consensus. Right. The Mrs. Thatcher said there's no alternative. It was known as you've all heard the slogans.
And well, this is neoliberalism. They're bringing poverty.
Exactly. It right. brought poverty. So what Putin has said, or what the prime minister of the Russian Federation has said, is that we go back to import substitution industrialization.
Right.
And this is significant because the rest of the underdeveloped world that has functioned under the aegis of the IMF and the World Bank, they're very important. I know this because I talk with diplomats who served in Africa and in South America, and they, with these countries, there was so much pressure. They couldn't go back to import substitution industrialization. They see this now in Russia as an example. This is completely different from what Klaus Schwab and co. want to accomplish. Now go back for a moment. This is one thing, sovereignty. Sovereignty is crucial. What is the most important thing that Klaus Schwab and Davos, the Davos crowds, want to do? We eliminate sovereignty altogether. Because right. that is the final victory of the top of the private sector. Sovereignty.
Here's where you and I have a serious disagreement. And that is, I see support in the West for Putin and what he's doing. And I think it's because it helps accelerate the process that they have underway. So it helps accelerate the shift to rebalancing the gold inventory. It accelerates the shift to do CBDC in the control grid. And so I just think that...
I don't understand what you are just saying, because the gold, I mean, by saying now we take gold as a base price for gold against the ruble. That means the first...
Only domestically.
Yeah, but that, never mind. Never mind, because it's domestically. But the Arabs go for it. Yeah, the Chinese go for it. India goes for it. Pakistan, we don't know now, because we don't know what's going to happen. But I think Africa...
I think that's all part of where Mr. Global wants to take
no,
the global...
No, of course not.
Currency. We have to...
It's out of their hands.
That's going to be part three, okay?
It's out of their hands. Because
I disagree.
It is the opposite of what they want.
And
if this, if this readoption of import substitution industrialization is accepted and brought back in many parts of Africa and in South America,
it's a real
then
problem.
It's the opposite of what Schwab is trying to do.
So there's who's at the
exactly
top.
Exactly the opposite.
There's who's at the top table, and then who's at the middle table. And I think we're battling who's at the middle table and what models they get to do. But I don't see the battle about the top model, because if the digital control grid goes into place.
Yeah, but how is this? What kind of digital control is it going to be?
If every human's on a blockchain, it's going to be slavery.
Yeah, but that's not what they're thinking of.
It's going to be centrally controlled.
That's not what they're. From what I understand, that the Chinese and the Russians are trying to put together is a substitute for a reserve currency that is not gold or your own currency. So a substitute for the dollar, because the dollar has been the favorite reserve currency ever since Bretton Woods. And this is...
So here's what I have to tell you.
Yeah.
Mr. Global couldn't care less whether it's the dollar or wampum. What Mr. Global wants is 100% digital, because that's the control. And
not depends on how you set it up. I have looked at the Bitcoin system and the other allied and competing cryptocurrency things, and there are different models that work differently, and you can find ways that are impossible to break into. There are other ways that are easily manipulable. There is a whole world out there, and there is not one kind.
But it's not just, I'm not talking about crypto, I'm talking about digital.
Yes, because that is digital.
Well, so is Visa.
No, you talk about blockchain in a way that like Bitcoin works.
What I'm talking about is an all digital system which can be controlled centrally using AI and software.
So, yes, if you study this crypto world, this cryptocurrency world, then you see that there are ways that are not controllable.
I totally disagree.
No. I know the arguments.
I know the arguments. I totally disagree.
But we don't know what the Russians and the Chinese until now have come up with. But I can assure you that they will do everything in their power to make sure that they can't be hijacked by Schwab and Co. This is something we can be absolutely sure of.
So here's part of, and I think this is totally true. You know, the Russians and the Chinese, whatever their control grid is, they want it run by Russians and Chinese as opposed to the City of London. Okay, so we're debating who the middle management is in the control grid. I think there are people who would like not to have a digital control grid.
Yeah.
I'm one of them.
No, I agree with you. If I had a choice, of course. I had all digital control stuff out of the window.
Right.
Telephones out of the window. I mean, telephones to make telephone calls. Go back to where you were.
Landlines.
30 years ago when they were wonderful. But
so there's all of these things we're going to discuss in part three.
Catherine, it was great.
Thank you very much.
To do it again. And notwithstanding our... The things that we could bet upon and one of us could lose.
This is how we figure it out. Anyway.
Thanks again.
Thank you for joining us on the Solari Report. Right.